accession number 19926, reel 2.
Bernard Xavier, reel 2.
I went before all these officers, and the Commodore of Collington said to me, "A job well done, son. We'll see you later on." After that, I never saw them again. I was transferred to Aberdeen Naval Base.
When you were evacuating these troops, what condition were they in?
The troops, well, they're all very shaky, obviously. Now, the Rolls Court boys told me that some of the Japanese, the Scottish boys, they surrendered to the Japanese, but the Japanese killed them and cut the testicles off, shoved in the mouth and hanged them upside down.
Do you think it was true?
That I do not know. That was what I was told in the ferry whilst coming from Kowloon back to Hong Kong.
Were there any wounded amongst the
Yes, troops? Several. Several of the boys could not walk. They had to be carried. They were the Royal Scot boys and a few Canadians too. I had a Canadian sergeant with me.
Did they have weapons with them?
Yes. Rifles. Not heavy armory. Rifles and I believe it was Tommy gun or something like that. Can't see probably, it was quite dark then because it was blackout.
Did you speak to any of the civilians who were being evacuated?
We did not evacuate any of the civilians. It was only all soldiers.
Did the soldiers tell you anything else?
Well, some of them were in tears. They expected reinforcement, but they got none.
How long does the crossing take?
It took about 25 minutes normally because it was so dark. Usually, I think 15 minutes. But it was so dark, other small little crafts was playing around and all that. I don't think the bloke could do his job properly, but he done it quite well though, to bring us all back safely. Then I was told, after meeting Commodore and all this, I was told that I'll be transferred to Aberdeen Naval Base. Well, when I got into Aberdeen, the naval base, I was billeted in one of the Salesian schools. It was taken over by the Navy then, commandeered by the Navy. And there, I saw my old buddy, Pony Moore, and another leading telegraphist, Edwards. He looked at me, he says, "What are you doing here, Sigmund?" I says, "Well, I was transferred here. I don't know what I'm going to do." He says, "Well, just sit down," he said. And on the wall, he looked at me and laughed. He said, Hong Kong, he wrote on the wall there, "Hong Kong will be forever British." And I had my meal there, and the draft came that I was to go on board HMS Barlight, which was then a minesweeper, just anchored outside Aberdeen. Stayed there 3 days doing nothing. We couldn't get out because the Japanese Navy was just surrounded the island. The Japanese went for us, I think, the plane. They tried to bomb us. I think it missed us by 100 yards. I'm sure it must be quite a big bomb, because all the doors and all that flew off. And then on the 19th, orders came that we scuttle the ship. And, well, we did scuttle the ship. I went back. I don't know, I was told to clear off if we were going to scuttle the ship. I went back to this Salesian school and was told to report back to battle headquarters in Hong Kong, naval base. A lorry was waiting to take several of us back to the naval base, but fortunately for us, the driver took the wrong turn. He was told to go through Repulse Bay area and through Wong Nai Chung Gap to get back to the naval base. But fortunately, he turned left instead of right. But we missed all this because the Japanese were doing terrific fighting there against the Canadians. And we took that route, we would have encountered the Japanese head on. Probably I wouldn't be here today. So I went back to the naval base in Hong Kong, and they says, go and join forces with some of the boys outside, right away near the ferry terminal. It's like a pillar box, but it's not, made of sandbags. If you see the Japanese, just shoot them, but with rifles and 45. A big army 45, a revolver, because we never saw any fighting at all. But what I did encountered was the governor of Hong Kong at that time, Sir Mark Young. He was doing his rounds, and he met all these servicemen. And he said to me, "What are you doing here, son?" I said, "I'm drafted out here." He said, "Well, do a good job of it, won't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." That was the last time I saw him too. And then...
Had you ever met him before?
No. Now I heard of him, he's the governor of Hong Kong. And we stayed there till about the 24th, I think. Went back to the headquarters there on the 25th. They said, "Don't move, stay in the barracks." We stayed in the barracks, and I think about 11 o'clock, the officers said, "We have surrendered to the Japanese." This was on Christmas Day. So we all have to go to a place to surrender our arms. It was Murray Barracks. We all met there, and I handed in my revolver and my rifle and all that. And I met my officer, Signal Bosun Mitchell. He said, "Young man," he says, "you're Portuguese, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know, it's not me to tell you that you have to escape." He said, "But you know, it's every man's duty to escape if he can. But I can't force you and I can't tell you to." So he says, "Have you got any money, son?" I said, "No." I think he took out about 100 Hong Kong dollars. He said, "Here you are." He says, "There's a Portuguese consul." He said, "Go to him. He may be able to help you since you're Portuguese. And go to Macau if you can, because Portugal is neutral." Well, I was then in Hong Kong, but my family, as earlier stated, lived in Nathan Road, Kowloon. I couldn't get to them because there was no crossing, nothing until at that time. That was after the surrender. I stayed with my brother. Well, I walked out of camp. I just walked out of the camp. Took off my naval coat. I had my shirt and a sweater, pullover. I walked through the Japanese guard, but at that time, it was quite easy. Everything wasn't, how can I put it? It wasn't organized by the Japanese yet at that time. So I went to stay with my brother. He was a police sergeant in the Hong Kong police. I stayed with him. He kept me there. And I went back to the barracks where all the prisoners was. And I met several Portuguese boys. I said to them, I said, look, I said, there's a chance for you to get out. Get out, mate. I said, I'll help you. You know, I said, take off your tunic. They were volunteers. They were in British Army uniform. They took off that and we were there. Again with the army pullover. I took them right to my brother's place. We passed the governor's house. We saw the Japanese sentry there. And I said, you lads got to bow in front of the Japanese. Of course, nobody likes to do that, but we had to. Otherwise, they'll shoot you. So we walked past the sentry, and each one of us bowed at the sentry. We walked past, went to my brother's place. And well, they stayed with my brother. My brother was feeding all of us, I think, for about a month. And when they opened the line of communication between Hong Kong and Kowloon, I took a ferry boat again from Hong Kong to Kowloon to see my parents. And I saw my father and my mother, and the place was all looted. My father's house was all looted, although the Navy told me at that time that my family would be evacuated to Hong Kong. I presume they had no time. But my family got caught in Kowloon when the Japanese advanced.
Were they harmed?
Yes, my sister was. I only learned of this, that my sister was raped about 3 years ago from my brother. My brother told me this, because he was quite young yet, my younger brother. He told me this. I didn't know all of this time. But the Japanese, my father was a curio collector, expensive Chinese curio collection. I think the Japanese took most of it. We lost practically everything. And then in Kowloon, after about 2 weeks when I returned to Kowloon, I was trying to buy some rice and flour to make cakes and all that. And I saw Dr. Selvin Clark. He knew I was a neighbor. I knew him before. He said, wow, what are you doing? He says, don't let the Japanese catch hold of you. He said, you've got to be very careful. I said, yes. I said, I've given some money, I said to him, by my officer, and told me to report to the Portuguese consul. Oh, yes, he says. He said, the Portuguese consul lives in Ho Man Tin. And he says, have you got enough money? I said, well, I've got 100 Hong Kong dollars. He said, here you are, there's another $50 for you. He said, make the best of it, he said. See you after the war. Well, I went back, I spoke to my father. My father said, oh, yes. My father said, I've got a Portuguese passport. I'm Portuguese, he said. The Portuguese consul lives in Ho Man Tin. So go and see him. Tell him you're my son. You know, mention the name. I went to see Mr. Suarez for that time for the Portuguese consul. Oh, yes, yes, he says. You're Portuguese, he says. So he gave me a temporary pass with the stamp of the Portuguese pass there. And gave me a badge, Portuguese badge, which I put in my armband.
What did it look like?
Just a Portuguese flag. And, well, I was okay. I went back to my parents, but underneath us, there was a barber shop, a hairdresser. And these Chinese people knew I was in the Navy because I used to come home and I'm off duty to see my parents in uniform. And my mother said to me, "Son, these people are working for the Japanese. You've got to be very, very careful. Try to keep a low profile as much as you can," which I did. And I had this money. And I think after about 2 months or 3 months, they started having the ferry boats plying between Hong Kong and Macau. So the Portuguese consul gave me a ticket. I went to see him again, by the way. He gave me a ticket to go to Macau, which I did. By the way, I had a letter from my officer commanding at that time, was D.M. Mitchell. He was a warrant officer, stating that I'm in the Royal Navy, and if anyone could give me help and protection, do so. I had this letter from him. I had it slip under my shoe. I went to Macau. On arrival there, I asked one of the Portuguese policemen, "Is there such thing as a British consul in Macau?" "Oh yes," he says. He gave me the address. I can't remember the name of the place now. He said, "That's the address I know." So I went there. We arrived in the afternoon. I went there same day as I arrived. I had no clothes, nothing at all, except what I've got on. And I knocked at the door. He came out. "Said, who's this?" "Or who's that?" So I said to him, I said, "I'm an escapee from the Navy, from Hong Kong." "Oh," he said, "you better come in." So, and right next to the British consul at that time was the Japanese consul. And he said, "Well, be very discreet about it." I said, "Yes." So I showed him the letter and my pay book. "Oh," he says, "is that all you got on?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you better fix yourself some clothes, don't you?" He said, you find out, you know, where you can buy these clothes." And he gave me money to stay in a hotel, which I did. I stayed for a few days, and I got myself all dressed up again, you know. And he said, "Well, you can't stay in a hotel all the time." He said, "But there is a British ferry boat that got stuck in Macau by the name of Sion, S-A-I-O-N. That ship still flies the British flag," he says. So he gave me a letter to see Captain Mitchell. That was a ship's skipper. Straight away he put me up. He said, "Take your pick in the cabins," he says. "It's all yours." So I picked my own cabin. And I stayed in Sion for about 3 months. One day, I was called up. He says, "Look," he says, "you can't stay in Macau for an indefinite period of time. Your best bet is, are you willing to go to Free China to carry on?" I said, "Yes." He said, "No point in me staying in Macau." So we made arrangements, and one day we met in a certain spot. All the English, Portuguese boys, all ex-servicemen assembled in a point, and we traveled by junk from Macau to Free China.
About how many of you were there?
Well, there's quite a few British people too. Mrs. Simpson, she was the wife of the superintendent of police in Hong Kong with her two sons. And Mr. Stott, I think he was quite a big shot in the public service in Hong Kong. Quite a few are. I don't know their names. The second officer of the Sion was also with us. McCool was his name. We were each given a .38 revolver. And we boarded this junk. I think we left about 2 a.m. in the morning. And halfway through the voyage, the trip, Japanese patrol boats were sighted. The Chinese crew said to us, stay quiet. Don't make a noise, don't move. Least noise will attract these patrol boats. They're all armed with heavy guns and all that. What chance have we got against them? And of course, the kids of Mrs. Simpson start to cry. And we were anxious in case the Japanese could hear the cries. I think someone had some candies or sweets, gave it to the boys, and they stopped crying. We anchored for about 3 or 4 hours until the all clear was given. I don't know how they get this all clear information from, but given the all clear, so we proceeded to Free China. And when we landed in Free China, we got a spokesman for us. His name is Bobby Laurel. He gave these Chinese people a line of blarney, so to speak, that we are volunteers to come to China to fight the Japanese.
Do you know what dates this was about?
I can't remember the
date. In 42?
In 42, yes, in 42. And, the Japanese gave us terrific banquets. The Chinese gave us terrific banquets. Every port of call we called, they looked after us. And we were all on the chairs. The Chinese used to carry us on their chairs, all the way down. Every port.
On their shoulders, you mean?
They got a chair, like two. A bloke in front and a bloke behind. I don't know how to describe it, but they're tough guys.
Like sedan chairs?
Sedans, that's right. They're the sedan chairs. And until we reach Wuchao. When we reach Wuchao, a British army captain by the name of Captain Wright met us. And again, we traveled by sedan chairs to Kuailin. That took, in all, about 30 days. When we arrived in Kuailin, they took us to BAAG headquarters.
Can you say what BAAG means, please?
British Army Aid Group. It was opposite the Lakeside Hotel, which we was billeted there. And, I think 2 days afterwards, we paraded in the BAAG compound in front of a colonel called Colonel Wright. He welcomed us back. He says, it's nice to see all you boys back. And how are you boys getting on? We said, it's all right. And we all had to eat outside. We was given money to eat outside in the restaurants because they got no cooks, nothing at all in the headquarters there. And after about a week, then we start training, like marching to keep ourselves fit. Well, whilst we was there for about 2 or 3 weeks training. This spokesman, Bobby Laurel, again, he was more or less like telling the Chinese what we're going to do and so forth. And we got a strong football team. And we would like to play them. play a Chinese team, if they could muster a Chinese team, which they did. But our group, this fellow Bobby Laurel, called our group the Portuguese Volunteer Group. But it wasn't consisted only of Portuguese boys. Some of them were Eurasian, some of them were British, English boys. We haven't got enough to muster a team. Of course, we were all out of condition. The first game we played against, it was Portugal versus China. We drew with them 2-2. And of course, after a while, it went all over the papers in Kuala Lumpur that Portugal played China and they drew with China 2-2. Of course, it was a laughing matter. Sometime afterwards, this fellow from Hong Kong, he calls himself Tiger Bomb King. He calls Wu Ho. His name is the owner of the Tiger Bomb, which is very famous in Hong Kong and Singapore. He's got his squad. They're all professionals. Of course, they heard that Portugal had a team in Kuala Lumpur, drew with China 2-2. He put his entire professional squad against us. This fellow, Bobby Laurel, accepted that invitation to play China, but didn't expect these professionals to play us. Because when the game started, we lost 11-0. We start our training like every morning in the BAG compound. I think for about 4 months, until orders came to get the boys over to India. They all volunteered for the army. I was left out. The army could not accept me. The navy will not release me. So I got stuck in Kuala Lumpur all the time, doing nothing in Kuala Lumpur. And I wanted to join the American services.
Why was that?
Well, I was doing nothing in Kuala Lumpur, sitting there. I got so fed up. So I went to see one of these padres, and his name is Mr. Richardson, I believe. He's an American. I said to him, I said, here. I knew him in Macau. He was amongst our group leaving Macau to Kuala Lumpur. And I said, how about you getting me in the United States forces? He says, you're in the Navy, British Navy. I said, yeah, but I said, use your influence to try to get me in. Well, he said, all right, I'll try my best. A few days later on, he called me in. He says, look, he says, I had a word with a Captain F.R. Otte of the OSS. They call it G2. He said, he wanted to see you. I said, okay. Made an appointment, I went to see him. He said, I'm Franklin Delano Otte, he says, of the United States Army Air Force at that time, the 14th United States Army Air Force. And I talked for a while. He said, what did you do in the Navy and all that? I told him I was in the signals, coding and decoding messages, if I can. I said, helping out. Like, he said, oh, that's useful, he said. He said, how about you be an agent of ours? I said, that's exactly what I want. I said, but I would prefer to join the army. He said, but we can only put you on probation, he says. You can't join the United States Army. I've got to get the authority from the British government, he says.